This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the military watchdog is looking at more than 50 cases of unlawful conduct in Afghanistan by Australian forces, including execution and brutalisation of civilians. That's our top story tonight, but also the Treasurer's warning that the economic damage from coronavirus will be worse than the summer's fires. And Harvey Weinstein's going to jail for rape, but he was acquitted on more serious charges. So is there still work for the Me Too movement to do?
If even he can't be convicted on all charges, I believe that the changes that the Me Too movement will bring in Hollywood and elsewhere will certainly take much longer to see their full effects.
Military investigators are looking into 55 potential war crimes allegedly committed by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan. A four-year investigation into rumours about the conduct of some soldiers during the decade-long conflict is nearing its end. The new details are contained in a report tabled in Federal Parliament today, which our political reporter Tom Iggledon has been reading. Tom, welcome. This investigation has been shrouded in secrecy. So what have we learned from this report today?
Well, Linda, for the first time, we've really heard about the breadth of this inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force, and as you said, going for some 4 years now. And as you said there, the number of incidents he is looking into now numbers 55, which is the first time we've heard a number like that. It's also the first time that it's been publicly acknowledged that these aren't incidents that occurred during the heat of battle, during normal combat, but incidents that involve the treatment of people who were either civilians, Linda, or prisoners. And it also acknowledges for the first time that the time frame looking ahead of when we will start to hear about the results of this inquiry and why it's taken 4 years to get to the bottom of what started out, according to today's report, as rumours. The investigators have been to Afghanistan a couple of times at least, and we heard today in this report that some 338 witnesses, both here and in Afghanistan, have been interviewed as part of this very extensive investigation. And finally, it acknowledges, as I said, that the investigation is now in its final stages of evidence taking. That is the step before deciding whether that evidence will add up to charges being laid and recommendations for further action, Linda.
Now, the government has been loath to talk about all of this, but do we know something of the specifics of the allegations now?
We do, because there has been some media reporting of some of these incidents that it's believed this inquiry is looking into. And that, of course, includes here at the ABC and the Afghan Files report of a few years ago. Hundreds of pages of leaked documents revealing potential unlawful killings of unarmed civilians, including children, during the conflict. And a culture of officers turning a blind eye to some very questionable behaviour, according to these documents. Now, of course, Linda, that report sparked a raid last year by Federal Police on the ABC's Ultimo headquarters, where you are, the object of which seems to have been tracking down the sources of those leaks, Linda.
And any political reaction after the tabling of this progress report?
Well, just a very little bit. As you can understand, politicians are a bit loath to talk about this while this investigation does continue. However, it was the Defence Minister, Linda Reynolds, that tabled this report today, that gave us this information to Parliament. And she also issued a statement. She expects to hand that report, when it's finished, to the Chief of Defence in the next few months, according to her, who will then decide on further action. She adds that Australians expect these sorts of allegations to be properly investigated, but also that those who are the subject of the allegations are treated fairly. Meanwhile, Labor's Shadow Defence Minister Richard Marles has issued me with a statement saying that Labor does support the independent inquiry from the Inspector General and that Australians must have confidence that their armed forces are operating in a professional and legal manner. Linda.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. Tom Iggledon, our political reporter in Canberra. Well, this week's sudden spread of the coronavirus to new corners of the world is continuing to send markets plunging, and market watchers say they just don't know what the eventual economic and financial cost will be. Inside China, more than 77,000 cases are reported and 2,600 deaths. But it's the quick rise in cases in Italy, Iran and South Korea this week that's delivered the real shock to markets. More than 2,000 cases are now reported in 28 countries outside China, with 23 deaths. Those are World Health Organization numbers. Well, today, billions more dollars were wiped off the value of stocks as investors bailed out, delivering another blow to the federal budget surplus and some talk about the possibility of a recession in Australia this year. Let's get some analysis of all of this with our business reporter, David Taylor. Evening, David.
G'day, Linda.
How widespread is the financial damage, first of all, today? Is it global?
It is global. And look, it was the news of the spike in cases in Italy and South Korea over the weekend that really spooked markets, because prior to that, last week, it seemed as if financial markets hadn't quite appreciated the extent of the economic damage should this virus get out of control. So if you look right across the globe, London's FTSE down 3% overnight, Germany's DAX down 4%, Wall Street off 3.5%. I should add, in the early signs, very early signs at this point, that selling on Wall Street tonight, our time, may look a little lighter than it has, and possibly even a rise. But that's also consistent with a possible future correction in stock prices where there's a big fall. Often they do bounce and then they fall down again. But look, in terms of stocks that have been particularly hard hit, airline and technology stocks have been hard hit. Delta Airlines in the US shares fell 6%. American Airlines slid 8%. Singapore Airlines says it's frozen recruitment for ground positions due to the impact of coronavirus. The tech giant Apple's really feeling the heat. And Linda, for commodities too, oil's fallen off a hill. And the price of gold, though, it's up as people seek a safe haven.
And for Australia, who's most at risk from all of this carnage on the markets over the spread of the virus?
In terms of the economy, Linda, it's fairly widespread. As I mentioned, travel companies like Qantas have been hard hit. If you're looking at those who export to China, BHP is an example of that. It's been hard hit. Consumers, there's a possibility people will have less money in their pockets moving forward if the economy slows. So companies like JB Hi-Fi have also been hit. Tourist hubs, universities, they're all in the firing line. Individually, though, many Australians at or approaching retirement might be particularly worried this evening about how the value of their superannuation is faring right now.
Okay, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer fronted the media today. What did they have to say?
Well, it's interesting. There was a barrage of media questions as they spoke. But look, the economic fallout, as you mentioned in the intro, of the coronavirus is said to be worse than the bushfires. But Scott Morrison at the same time has ruled out a fiscal stimulus package. In other words, more spending by the government. But there's obviously intense interest from the media to know what the government might do to further support the economy. As you're about to hear, here's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison.
The information changes almost every day, both on the clinical side as well as what we're learning about the economic impacts and the duration of what the impact of this virus will be and its impact around the global economy is also not known at this point. So again, we can respond to questions where the answer is known in relation to that matter. Well, obviously at this point, those variables can't be fully considered, and by the time we get to the... I haven't finished my response yet. Settle down. What I'm saying is we will deal with that at the time of the budget. Now, when we framed the budget a year ago, I mean, hands up those who thought there was going to be a coronavirus epidemic when the budget was released last May. Of course no one did. These are unknown global shocks.
Scott Morrison there. Now, look, there are clearly a lot of unknowns about this virus at the moment. Philippa Jones is the Managing Director at China Policy. It's a group dedicated to analysing China's response to major events just like this. I caught up with her in Sydney and asked if we have any measure at all of the economic fallout yet.
No, I don't think it can. I think that when we look at the spread internationally now, we have to take it. It becomes a different picture.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
It is. It is indeed.
In terms of China's policy response so far, and indeed Australia's policy response, does it stack up to you?
China's policy response, yeah, you know, we do this day in, day out. It's a hyper-functional government. So the policy comes out at an extraordinary rate. So they are focusing on everything they've got to do. Whether they can implement it, whether it gets done, is we have to wait and see.
There really is no at this point, there's no idea of how we're going to emerge from this. So is it too optimistic to think that both Australia and China will emerge fairly rapidly in the second quarter economically out of this?
Well, unfortunately, what we've seen in the past is that Australia tracks China quite closely. If the government's focus on getting back to work works, then it may not be quite sort of...
But there's obviously still a lot of uncertainty here.
Oh, there's uncertainty everywhere.
China Policy's Philippa Jones speaking with our business reporter David Taylor. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, on the ABC Listen app, and of course we're via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, the death of the pioneering NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson, an inspiration for the film Hidden Figures. She's now inspiring a new generation of female astronomers.
She was incredible, and that kind of inspired me that, you know, if she could program on a piece of paper and stick it into a computer the size of my bedroom, then I can program on my keyboard while watching Netflix.
Harvey Weinstein's accusers have been expressing relief after a jury in Manhattan topped the dramatic downfall of the movie mogul with guilty verdicts on two counts of sexual assault, including rape.
This is an example for many to follow. Someone that even this powerful can never treat people in that way that he did and think it would never be prosecuted.
It is, in fact, a great day. The trash has been taken out. The fact that we are white women and attractive and of some means, and it still took this many of us to even get him to have one day in court, just tells you and sends you the message very clearly how almost impossible it is to even be heard, period, let alone any kind of conviction.
I hope it really says to all those other predators in the world, we're coming for you next, buddy.
The voices of some of the women who have spoken out against Harvey Weinstein. Well, the convictions follow 2017's revelations of Weinstein's predatory and abusive behaviour towards women, which sparked the global Me Too movement of women outing powerful men for similar behaviour. Following the guilty verdict, Weinstein was admitted to hospital, reportedly complaining of chest pains. He'll be sentenced next month and then faces further charges in Los Angeles. But today's outcome was mixed, with the jury dismissing more serious charges of sexually predatory conduct. Christina Cordarucci is a writer for the US publication Slate and is host of the Slate podcasts Waves and Outward. We spoke earlier.
The two women whose cases were at the forefront of this case, Jessica Mann and Miriam Haley, they were what some people would call complicated victims, or they had complicated cases. So the defense really harped on the fact that they had contact with Harvey Weinstein after their assaults, that they, you know, sent him friendly sounding messages. So I think the fact that the jury found him guilty of rape in the third degree against one of them and criminal sexual act against the other is a testament to the fact that the Me Too movement and other advocacy over the past several decades has made it possible for women to not be, quote unquote, a perfect victim and to still find some measure of justice in the criminal justice system. But Harvey Weinstein was acquitted of the two most serious charges brought against him, predatory sexual assault. So I think for a lot of people watching this case, that was a disappointment.
I mean, Weinstein was protected for so long and so powerful, of course. I mean, that's one of the defining features of these cases, isn't it? It's just the enormous influence and capacity to either make or break someone's career. Do you think this has really been kind of better highlighted for people, that people like him need to be, you know, a light needs to be shone on people like him? We can't just believe them all the time because they're powerful?
Oh, completely. I mean, the complexity of these cases, the fact that the defense had to argue that these were transactional sexual encounters, that of course these women might not have found him attractive or necessarily liked having sex with Harvey Weinstein, but, you know, they were just maybe trying to get a job. I mean, the way that they were defending him made so clear the level of power that he was wielding over these women. I think this case has really been a turning point in the way people think about how power in Hollywood, in media, in workplaces, in every industry functions, and functions to protect people at the very top when they behave in criminal ways.
A turning point, perhaps, but the kind of turning point that means we see the end of the casting couch? I mean, what do you think will be the impact on Hollywood specifically?
There have been some changes in Hollywood. I mean, one of the major changes that we have already started to see is increasing employment of intimacy coordinators who come onto sets where movies or television shows are being filmed and advocate for people who are involved in sex scenes. I mean, this is something that's very small, but possibly very significant. But then again, I mean, as we've seen in Harvey Weinstein's case, he wasn't even able to be convicted on all charges. If even he can't be convicted on all charges, I believe that the changes that the Me Too movement will bring in Hollywood and elsewhere are possibly significant, but will certainly take much longer to see their full effects borne out.
Well, Harvey Weinstein's lawyers say they will now appeal these convictions, so there's more angst to come. How is that going to play out?
That's a good question. I think it depends on what grounds they appeal on. In some cases, the victims may have to testify again. In others, they may not. So, you know, Donna Rotunno, his lead attorney, has been out in the media saying things like, well, the Me Too movement has gone way too far. And if they enter a hotel room late at night and a man is in there, what do they expect? So she's almost been trying to poison every potential jury pool and by making them think that, well, there's basically no situation under which you can convict somebody of sexual assault if the woman or the survivor or alleged survivor is always to blame.
Christina Cortarucci, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Christina Cortarucci from Slate. Well, Australia's Jewish and Muslim communities have welcomed the ASIO chief's public discussion of the spy agency's concerns about right-wing extremism in Australia. Delivering his first annual threat assessment last night, Mike Burgess also revealed the agency had foiled a sleeper agent from an unnamed country and sounded an alarm about the high number of foreign agents operating here. But it was his reference to ASIO's focus on cells of neo-Nazis in Australia that caught the attention of Jewish and Muslim leaders, who say they hope it's more than just talk. Alex Tai reports.
Director General of ASIO Mike Burgess was candid about the threat of terrorism in Australia. An attack, he said, was probable. And the source of that attack could be a new version of an old threat.
Right-wing extremism has been in ASIO's sights for some time, but obviously the threat came into sharp, terrible focus last year in New Zealand. In Australia, the right-wing extremist threat is real and it is growing. In suburbs around Australia, small cells meet regularly, salute Nazi flags, inspect weapons, train in combat and share their hateful ideology.
It's a stark image and a clear warning that the neo-Nazi ideologies which fermented on the internet are now posing a physical danger to Australians. Michael Wesley is the Deputy Vice-Chancellor International at the University of Melbourne and an expert on national security. In his 20 years of watching ASIO, he says it's only recently it's named right-wing extremism as a terrorist threat.
Particularly in the aftermath of the Christchurch massacre, acknowledging the rise of dangerous far-right groups with violent tendencies is something that really needed to be done.
Professor Wesley says the speech by the ASIO boss signals a change in the nature of national security.
Intelligence agencies realise that they have to work in partnership with institutions and people from within society. So the intelligence challenge seems to have gone from being a kind of a spy versus spy type operation to more of an all-society challenge.
So how has the message been received in Australia's minority communities? Dr. Davir Abramovich is the chairman of the Anti-Defamation Commission.
I think this is the wake-up call that Australia had to have.
Following the ASIO boss's speech, Dr. Abramovich wants to see social media companies and governments take concrete steps to fight right-wing extremism. He raised the possibility of designating neo-Nazi groups as terrorist organisations.
And hopefully this will motivate our elected representatives to take decisive action to deal with this growing threat. We don't need a Christchurch in our country to actually open our eyes and to realize that we have violent extremists walking our streets.
Bilal Rauf is the spokesperson for the Australian National Imams Council. He says that since the Christchurch attack in New Zealand, Australians attending mosques have been worried about their safety.
So as a matter of practice, a lot of mosques have in fact engaged private security to stand outside the entrance to try and give some comfort to the people that visit these places of worship.
And like Dr. Abramovich, he welcomes the speech from ASIO and wants it to translate into real action.
These things are happening, they are real, and they are creating a great deal of concern on the part of many Australian citizens. So there needs to be steps, more active steps taken, not just discussion, to flush them out and to deal with them.
Despite ASIO's alarm about a right-wing threat and left-wing extremism not being mentioned in the speech, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton is keen to make sure all ideologies are in the crosshairs.
Look, you can use Islamic extremist, you get in trouble for using that. You can use left-wing to describe everybody from the left to the right. You know, left-wing, right-wing, I said today I don't care where people are on the spectrum. If they pose a threat to our country, if they want to do harm to Australians, then they're in our sight.
Okay, so when you refer to left-wing terrorism, do you mean these Islamist groups?
Yes, I do, and anybody in between.
The Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton speaking with Patricia Karvelis. Alex Tai with that report. Well, after spending years and likely millions of dollars trying to win federal government and public support to drill for oil in the Great Australian Bight, resource giant Equinor seemed all but certain to go ahead with the project. But today, a shock announcement that it's bailed out. Some are lamenting the loss of economic benefits, others welcome the outcome on environmental grounds. PM's Rhett Burney reports.
Port Lincoln is a seaside town in South Australia where many make their living from fishing and tourism. It's also not far from the Great Australian Bight, where, up until this morning, Norwegian oil giant Equinor had planned to drill for oil.
We'd spent, quite a bit of time discussing it last year and looking at both sides of the argument and why it is a threat to our amazing environment here.
That's Port Lincoln school teacher Lisa Kirshner.
You know, kids see things pretty plainly and they just think, you know, it's pretty straightforward that we need to protect it. So, yeah, they were very, very excited to learn the news and to know that it's safe.
Equinor was granted environmental approval to drill in the Bight just 2 months ago. That sparked upset and anger, with environmentalists worried drilling for oil posed a grave danger to marine life and risked an oil spill that, in a worst-case scenario, could spread all the way to Sydney's beaches. Equinor spent millions on commissioning safety reports and PR campaigns spruiking jobs and economic benefits to try and win over community support. So why now the change of heart?
Equinor has concluded that the project is not commercial competitive compared to other opportunities for Equinor worldwide.
Eunice Dungeland is Equinor's manager in Australia. He maintains the plan was always environmentally safe.
Now we receive bids for doing this operation. The main procurement activities included the rig, the helicopters, and also the supply base activities. And now it's just sorted out that this is too expensive.
Dr. Graham Bethune is the head of independent energy market analyst, EnergyQuest. He says most major resource companies have set themselves carbon emissions reduction targets, spurred on by the strict rules put in place by the European Union. He says emissions from oil are higher than other fossil fuels, and that could have influenced Equinor's decision.
One of the trends that's clear at the moment is that the European companies in particular are focusing more on gas than on oil. And one of the reasons for that is the carbon targets that they've set themselves.
Both the Federal Resource Minister Keith Pitt and the Shadow Resource Minister Joel Fitzgibbon have said they're disappointed by Equinor's decision to bail out of the Bight. Interest groups too, including South Australia's Chamber of Mines and Energy, aren't happy. Rebecca Knoll is the CEO.
An opportunity that would have really started to position this state towards its 3% growth target and really delivered jobs not just jobs, but economic prosperity to the whole of South Australia, hospitals, roads, arts.
And Rebecca Knoll says opponents of oil exploration in the Bight are partly to blame.
I'm not privy to the decision-making of Equinor, but I'm quite sure that the opposition that this project has received, mostly misinformed opposition, has weighed into that conversation.
Meanwhile, environmental groups are claiming victory. Greenpeace has labelled Equinor's withdrawal a win for people power and nature, noting the company is the third major oil giant behind BP and Chevron to abandon plans to drill in the Bight since 2016. The Wilderness Society agrees. Its spokesman is Peter Owen.
We're calling on the Australian government, obviously, to stop releasing leases in the Bight, and when the current leases come up for renewal, to not renew them and to actually protect the Great Australian Bight from the industrialisation of the oil and gas industry.
Others, like the Australia Institute, want the Great Australian Bight World Heritage listed, which it says will effectively ban any future exploration for fossil fuels.
Rhett Burney with that report. Well, Hollywood stars, NASA, and the former US President Barack Obama are among those paying tribute today to a mathematician who played a key role in the first moon landing and early space missions. It's a career all the more remarkable because Katherine Johnson, who has died at the age of 101, was African-American and a woman. The story of Katherine Johnson and her co-workers was made famous by the 2016 film Hidden Figures. Barbara Miller's been looking back at her life.
Contact light. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
It was one small step for a man, made possible in part because of the behind-the-scenes work of a woman. Katherine Johnson was one of what were known as computers at the American space agency NASA, calculating by hand rocket trajectories and Earth orbits. When she and her black co-workers first started out at NASA, they were segregated not only from the men there, but from the white women.
Katherine Johnson.
Recognition came late in life. Katherine Johnson was in her 90s when she appeared at the Oscars alongside the cast of the 2016 film Hidden Figures, which told the story of the bright young girl.
Equilateral, trapezoid, isosceles, tetrahedron.
Who went on to do great things.
On any given day, I analyze the manometer levels for air displacement, friction, and velocity, and compute over 10,000 calculations by hand.
The accolades then came thick and fast.
The official naming ceremony for the future Katherine G. Johnson Computational Research Facility.
She was also awarded the USC's highest civilian honor.
Give them a big round of applause, 2015 Presidential Medal of Freedom winners.
But like many unsung heroes, Katherine Johnson was modest, saying she had only ever done her best to answer the questions put to her.
And I did that to the best of my ability at all times, correct or incorrect.
In a statement, NASA said it was deeply saddened by her loss.
Her dedication and skill as a mathematician helped put humans on the moon, and before that made it possible for our astronauts to take the first steps in space. At NASA, we will never forget her courage and leadership and the milestones we could not have reached without her.
Even though she lived a really long life, it was actually really sad, just because she was such a role model to so many young women, to hear that she had passed away.
Astronomer Sarah Webb is a PhD candidate at Swinburne University's Centre for Gravitational Wave Discovery, who around the time Hidden Figures was released was struggling with some complex problems.
I was still doing my undergraduate in physics, and I personally was quite struggling with being one of the only females in my cohort and just feeling like I was maybe a little bit behind in my computer programming skills. And I was just Googling, like, famous mathematician women, and because I'd seen Hidden Figures and I was reading all of their profiles. And it was her profile that stuck out the most because she was incredible. And that kind of inspired me that, you know, if she could program on a piece of paper and stick it into a computer the size of my bedroom, then I can program on my keyboard while watching Netflix. So I took to Google to try find, you know, inspirational stories to get me out of my coding slump. And it worked because now I program every day for at least 8 hours a day, and it's one of my favourite things to do.
Catherine Johnson died of natural causes at a retirement village in Virginia. She's survived by two of her three daughters, six grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren.
Barbara Miller with that report. I'm Linda Mottram, and that's PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review while you're there. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The Order of Australia is supposed to recognise the very best in the community. And there's a growing list of people who are arguing that men's rights campaigner and social commentator Bettina Arndt doesn't meet that standard. And they want a reward taken away.
Today, how political is the Order of Australia? And what happens if we start revoking awards? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.